Welcome to the Perimenopausal Mamas Podcast for hormonal mamas who want to reclaim their own natural state of health to thrive and raise healthy kids. I'm Dr. Lisa Weeks, naturopathic doctor in Toronto, Canada. I'm a perimenopausal mama to my toddler named Stuart.
And I'm Dr. Toni Reed. I'm a naturopathic doctor, birth doula, and hypnobirthing educator in Calgary, Alberta. And I'm a perimenopausal mama to my little girl, Frankie. The information in this podcast is for educational and entertainment purposes only. It is not meant to substitute professional medical advice. Always consult with your licensed healthcare provider. Welcome back, everyone, to the Perimenopausal Mamas Podcast. This is Dr. Toni, and I have a special guest with me today because it can be a little challenging to have conversations with our kids about, you know, the birds and the bees. That's never easy. And for most of us, it can be really uncomfortable. And so I couldn't imagine having anyone else to help me and talk to me about navigating these conversations around sexual orientation, gender identity, that kind of thing with our kids, other than Dr. Cindy Gilbert. Dr. Cindy was on a previous episode. We talked last year about forest bathing. It was amazing. So we'll definitely link to that episode in our show notes because she is not only a licensed and registered naturopathic doctor with prescribing rights in the province of Ontario in Canada, but she is also a teacher and an author. So she has a book on forest bathing. She has a book on women's health and herbal medicine. And, you know, she has a clinical focus in her practice on mental health, trauma, substance use, sexual and reproductive health, and LGBTQ2SIA plus health. So she's, I love that she's always been an activist in some way or another. That's very you, Dr. Cindy. And she is committed to a harm reduction and anti-oppression model of care for her patients, as well as in her teaching. She's previously taught at the Canadian College of Naturopathic Medicine in botanical medicine and naturopathic philosophy. And now most of her teaching is focused on cultural safety, competency, anti-oppression, and trauma-informed care. So thanks for joining us, Dr. Cindy. Really appreciate you being here with me.
Thanks so much for inviting me back. It's such a pleasure to come back and to talk about something that might seem like a really different topic, but is still like really much a part of the basics of what I do in practice and what I'm teaching. So it's very exciting and such an important topic for parents who have young kids and teens who are like trying to figure out how to talk about things like gender and sex and sexual orientation.
Absolutely. Because there can, you know, things are different than when we were growing up and kind of managing our confusion around kind of gender and sex and what this all means. And there's a lot of positives to that. And it's just can be a whole new world in terms of languaging and really supporting our kids to be who they are and feel safe and loved. Especially at home, because we have control around that. But also again, hopefully out in the world as well. You know, there's definitely conversations around that happening at school, at least in Canada. And I know it's kind of different from province to province, and maybe things aren't necessarily ideal around the curriculum that way. But no matter kind of where people are with the, you know, what their kids learn at school, it's really important to be having the conversations in an open way with our kids at home, not only to kind of reinforce who they are and help them figure that out, but just to, again, have, you know, home be a place and that conversation and communication be as open as it can be when kids are growing up.
Oh, yeah. I mean, I think it's like the the biggest hope and fear of every parent with like when they're looking, either they're looking forward to like what it might be like to have tweens and teens, or they're like on the cusp of that, or they're in the middle of teenage years, is that, you know, I think all parents want to be able to sustain open communication with their kids and have created that supportive family environment for every kid in their house. And you know, that's kind of like, regardless of everything else going around outside, like you said, like what's happening at school and what's happening in their communities or what's happening in the world, that we want to be able to create that space for our families at, in our household, where our kids feel like they can be themselves and can be supported and loved and taken care of. And that, you know, as parents, like we have that open line of communication in both directions, so that we also know what our kids are up to and how they're feeling about things and how they're feeling about themselves in the world. So
absolutely. Yeah. Okay. Why don't we like really get into the basics so that we have, everyone has a good foundation of kind of what we're talking about and how really, what makes sense in terms of the language of what we're talking about around gender and sex.
Yeah.
Can you do like a quick run through of like, what do we mean when we're talking about gender? What do we mean when we're talking about sex?
And I think like, this is such a key thing, because as you said, like when most of us as parents were growing up or going to school, like these kind of differentiators, or like the differences between sex and gender, were like not even necessarily discussed at all. Not that they didn't exist, but they weren't part of like everyday language. And they're still not quite, I'd say, part of everyday language. So like on the basics, when we're talking about sex, most of us kind of mean biological sex. It's like, you know, when a baby is born, whether it's like from a vaginal birth or a cesarean birth, that it doesn't matter, but usually there's somebody there who's like a midwife or a doctor or other birth attendant who picks up a baby and looks at their genitals and declares like that the baby is a boy or a girl. Usually there's times when that doesn't happen.
Yeah.
And sometimes,
or when they've seen it on an ultrasound.
Or right. When they've seen it on an, or when they've seen something or not seen genitals on an ultrasound. And that really we're like making that differentiation, not even based on chromosomes or what we think about chromosomes or what we think about biology or about like internal reproductive organs or all these other aspects that might relate to sex. But we're making that basis on like what somebody's genitals look like, right? Whether or not like we see a penis or we see a vulva when we're like looking at an infant or looking, as you said, at an ultrasound. Mm-hmm. So that's usually what we refer to when we call sex. And then we associate that with like an M or an F on forms and on identification and on birth certificates. And that's not to say that there aren't a whole bunch of people, right? Like around 1 or 2% of people who at that point where they're making a decision or assigning a sex at birth, which is how it's done by the attending person at a birth, is that there's sometimes that 1 or 2% of people where, based on genitals alone, we can't necessarily make that call. And those folks might be deemed intersex. There might be a whole bunch of other tests and question marks and like medical interventions that proceed in those kinds of situations. But that's all part of normal diversity of human physiology for the most part, is that, you know, and we don't all look the same when we're born in lots of different ways, including our genitals. And so that's the kind of the basis of sex, but sex is so much more than that. It's more than just genitals. Like I said, it's reproductive organs. It might include chromosomes, like whether or not you have XX or XY or XXY or other kind of variants on chromosomes and how that plays out. It also, you know, kind of like gives us that peek forward as to, you know, what kind of hormones might get produced in those bodies as someone goes through puberty and what kind of primary or secondary sex characteristics they might show up, how their bodies change, you know, where they grow hair, pubic hair or armpit hair or other body hair, you know, how their kind of bone structure shifts as they go through puberty is all part of sex. And so, you know, it's a little bit muckier than we make it out as being like either male or female, but we like to simplify things for ourselves.
Of course we do. Of course.
We should.
We like labels. We like simplifying.
Right.
Two camps, and right?
And so that's what we do. And that's okay, right? And I think for the most part, the reality is that that has served most people. Like I said, there are lots of people who that doesn't quite work for. And so, you know, that it's important for us to know that these categories don't always fit everybody in the way that we might like to. And sometimes we don't find out that those categories don't fit until 12, 14 years later.
Or maybe even longer,
or maybe never.
Or maybe never. Oh yeah. I mean, there's that.
Yeah. But that is still very different from what we call gender. And again, like most of the time, you know, based on those ultrasounds or based on the sex that gets assigned at birth, we make a determination or make an assumption that somebody's gender identity is correlated to that sex marker. And again, we do this for mostly like simplified reasons, but also because we haven't always separated those things out in our minds as to the differences or the distinctions between sex and gender. And gender is a bit more, I think, you know, in some ways it's more complex because it is a social category, right? It encompasses not just how we see ourselves, our gender identity, like what, how we think of ourselves as being feminine or masculine or androgynous or non-binary or genderqueer. And, you know, the kids, those Gen Z kids have like 1,000 different ways of identifying themselves. And that's really important for us to recognize because those, as you said, we like to put labels on things and sometimes those labels don't quite fit. And so we have to use new words to understand ourselves. And that can be really affirming for lots of people. But there's also, you know, this piece around gender that is about expression. That's how I express myself and how I relate to, you know, what are our norms and expectations in society around how women or girls behave, around how men or boys behave, or even, you know, anyone who's been into a clothing store or a toy store knows as a parent that there are these sections that look very different that often get labeled like boys' toys, girls' toys, or clothing for girls and clothing for boys that's very separated based on colors, based on fit, based on, you know, all sorts of ways that we kind of categorize how what our expectations are. And those have changed over time. And I think that's where we start to understand that gender, you know, isn't in some ways is more complex, because if we go back even within like, you know, kind of white European society in other times, that blue was actually a color that was associated with girls primarily at birth, and female born, like assigned infants were often dressed in blue and boys were dressed in pink. And anyone who's been in the store recently,
when did that change?
Oh, Dr. Tony, you're asking me about history. And
well,
I'm not reading
dates. You started it.
We'll put it in the show notes. We'll put it in the show notes, I promise. But it was a switchover that happened like relatively recently.
Wow.
And you know, like definitely in Victorian era that these colors were like completely opposite to how we think of those associations now. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, I think as like one of my kids wisely pointed out to me, they were like, colors don't belong to boys and girls, right? And I think, you know, that when we think those, we think through it, we've made these associations about how people perceive gender, right? So that if you have, you could have boys wearing pink and, or girls wearing blue, and that doesn't mean anything about their gender identity necessarily, but we might, or other parents might read into that if you're, you know, in a different section of the toy store than, you know, then might be presumed based on what people perceive as the gender of your kid that you're with or the one you're shopping for.
For sure. And there's so many assumptions and expectations that we can put on our kids. And then of course, other people and, you know, the outside community, whether it's other family members, extended family, friends, or, you know, in school, or even just the greater society at large of, you know, yeah, what is supposed to be in terms of behavior, way of dressing, language. Likes, dislikes, language.
Yeah, which toys you want to play with, which other kind of kids you want to play with, how you interact with people. Mm-hmm. I mean, there's so much around it, around social expectations. And I mean, that's the basics of how society works. But we can understand gender better, I think, as a social category, again, as this kind of thing that we, in a sense, like impose these ideas about how people should behave or act or what they should wear. Mm-hmm. When we start looking at other, like not just historically what the differences were in our expectations around gender, but also, you know, how gender has not always, or and continues not to be in many cultures, is not like a binary either or option. And that, you know, in some cultures around the world, traditionally there are more than four genders that are part and an important part of certain cultures and traditions. You know, certainly that 2S that you read out in my bio, that refers to two spirit, is, you know, one of those kind of closer to home, I think, for us as Canadians, where, you know, that there is an understanding that many Indigenous nations and cultures here in Canada and in the US, you know, had a different understanding of gender that, again, wasn't simply a simple binary where there were two options of masculine and feminine, or men and women, that there were other genders that had specific societal roles that were identified, that maybe, you know, embodied understandings of gender that exist outside of this kind of binary, that are difficult to define even using like terms like masculine and feminine, because there's it's not necessarily like a linear concept. A lot of people think about two-spirit as being like embodying both masculine and feminine identities. And sometimes that's true for some folks historically, but that two-spirit's also so much more than that. And that there is a piece around roles in the community and expectations around that, but also that, you know, these genders other than masculine and feminine are not on that linear concept. They're more like, I like to use the analogy of a galaxy, and that's one of the more kind of more common ways of thinking about it nowadays, is that, you know, that sometimes those feminine and masculine senses of ourselves or of people are overlapping. Sometimes they're really far apart. And also that there are other places kind of in a, you know, if you imagine like the three-dimensional sky where you could place gender, that really outside of like kind of mind-blowing for a lot of people, because we've grown up within these binary systems. And so that, I think, is one of the biggest challenges for parents, is even just kind of expanding our notions of what gender is, because most people maybe haven't even thought about the difference between sex and gender. They, you know, were assigned a sex at birth. Their gender is like aligned with that. So they have cisgender. And they've never, maybe they, you know, don't have that many people in their lives for whom that isn't true. And so they don't have a lot of lived experience around it. And it, you know, like I said, it's not that there weren't, that these concepts of gender understandings or even identities didn't exist before. It's that there was too much stigma in our societies for people to be open and talk openly about it, like we're doing.
Yeah.
And so people didn't feel comfortable. And so we didn't know about it necessarily.
For sure. And especially if, you know, for the vast majority of people, those kind of binaries and those kind of like traditional assumptions and expectations around gender and sex fit. So fine, great. And then, you know, how do we allow for that kind of the minority of people to be able to have a voice and to really be able to express really who they are?
Or to understand when our kids might be telling us something about themselves. And I think like that's a huge piece of it.
So huge. So huge. And it is about kind of giving that space too. You know, I feel very fortunate in the position that I am to be able to have the time and the resources to be able to think about these things and value these things, because I'm not just focused on survival and just focused on, again, kind of getting food on the table or paying the bills or, you know, where I live or again, having the roof over the head kind of thing, where I can really have the resources to spend on making sure that I am supporting another level of health of myself, my family, my kids, that kind of thing. And then it is about that kind of expanding the mind and expanding the way we think about things. Because I think even like traditionally, I've just thought about like sex and gender on like that spectrum, that linear spectrum of like you're one end or the other, or you're somewhere in the middle. But that's not really like how it is.
Yeah. And I mean, I think it's like there's, you know, it's so important to start somewhere, right? And I think like oftentimes, you know, parents in my own practice, they'll ask me similar questions, like, or they're exploring, you know, they're like, okay, I know that I, you know, maybe for me, this has been true and it's fit. And I want to be able to normalize this for my kids. And there's so many good reasons to do that. I mean, I think the biggest reason is that we know that kids who are more gender diverse or transgender, as well as kids who identify as like lesbian, gay, bisexual, or, you know, other kind of sexual orientations, that those kids really benefit from family support and parental support. You know, there's like 1,000 stats that parents encounter, and this happens often when parents talk to me in practice, is that they're worried about those statistics because they see statistics like, you know, kids who are LGBTQIA+ are more likely to, you know, use substances. They're more likely to suffer with mental health conditions. They're more likely to think about suicide and even act on those thoughts, and those scare parents, understandably, right?
Yes.
And like no parent wants to think about those risks for their kid, right? No parent is like, oh yeah, sign me up for anxiety, right? Like, obviously we want the best for our kids. And I think what's reassuring about those statistics and what I often share with parents is that all out of all the research over and over and over again, what we know from researching kids and teens who are LGBTQ2SIA+ identified is that across the board, parental support drastically diminishes all of those risks. So we know that kids who have parents who are very supportive have like high self-esteem, excellent mental health. They have, you know, excellent physical health, and they're satisfied with life compared to kids with parents who lack that parental support. And when we like really start to drum down on like actual statistics around like things like depression or thinking about suicide, that trans youth who have the highest rates of depression and suicide attempts, they go from having a risk that's like close to 60% of them having thought about like somewhere between 60 and 70% of trans youth thinking about hurting themselves or ending their lives. But with parental support, that number goes down to 4% for a suicide attempt.
Oh, so, that's amazing.
Which is consistent with like most teens. So, you know, you go from that, it shows that importance, like of what that support at home looks like in real terms, in terms of like real outcomes around mental health for kids, you know, and I think that's where parents, they just want to know what's going to be best for their kid. And, you know, parental support is how we save lives overall. And so, you know, I think it's like with that in mind that we can then think through like, okay, what does parent support look like, especially if, right? Especially if you yourself are cisgendered, and even if you're in a heterosexual relationship, that, and maybe you don't have like a whole lot of, so for some people, they might have friends in their like parent friend group who can model those model other kinds of family constellations or model other kinds of relationships or model other family structures. and genders even for their children, but not everyone does, right? Yeah. And so, you know, then it's like, okay, what kind of resources can I introduce to my kid to normalize this, to provide that support, to say, hey, you know, maybe we've assumed that you've been cisgender your whole life because that's kind of the norm, or maybe I incorrectly assumed that you were straight this whole time and heterosexual, but how do I create that space for my kid that says, like, I'm also okay if you're not, and I want you to be able to share that with me so that I can then be the supportive, loving parent that I am.
Yes.
Right. And so I think that that's where, like, books and resources are really important for parents to introduce and to kind of have at their disposal to help them with some of that language, to help them with, like, how do I talk to my kid about puberty and relationships or, like, crushes, right? Or, you know, what that looks like, because, you know, a sense of gender identity starts to develop for most people around 2 or 3, regardless of what they've been exposed to. It's pretty solidified between age 6 and 8 for most kids. And, you know, sexuality and sexual orientation is, like, has a longer term. Some kids are pretty sure of themselves really early, like 9, 10, even. They're like, I know who I, you know, am, like, kind of crushing on in vague terms, or even, like, sexually attracted to when I'm, like, you know, a tween or teen. Other kids, you know, may not show any signs of that sense or have that sense of themselves until later in teen years. And some kids might be asexual or aromantic, like, actually just not that interested and, like, more into playing sports or drawing or any number of activities and not so into it. And that's normal too. And so there's this, like, kind of variability. So I think, you know, it's partly, like, saying, hey, some people, you know, for some people, this is how it is, right? And we can always share those other ways of being with our kids through books and through having conversations, right? And just introducing, you know, the concept early on and not being afraid to talk about it. Kids, you know, kids don't come with, like, a whole lot of baggage. Like, they didn't grow up through, like, the HIV crisis. They didn't necessarily grow up through the 90s, though. If we look at the 90s and, like, you know, 90s rock stars, there was, like, a lot more flexibility in terms of gender expression.
Yeah, for sure.
Celebrities compared to now sometimes.
Yeah.
But there's so many different entry points to it, and really, like, thinking through what's best for my family and how do I want to approach these questions and answer them when my kid asks. Right.
For sure. Yeah. Cause I mean, and even just the way I think about it, it's just an expansion of that idea of, you know, that diversity that we can have our kids experience, you know, cultural diversity in terms of, you know, if that's not necessarily in the home, or even in extended family or friend groups. And then it's like, okay, you know, really letting our kids know, you know, that everyone's a bit different in terms of the way they look, but then expanding that in terms of, you know, again, how they express themselves and who they see themselves to be as well.
Yeah. And I think, I mean, there's the easiest point is, like, really, like, when, like, because we do this, we make assumptions all the time. So we might see a stranger in, like, a grocery store and, like, make an assumption about whether or not that person is a woman or a man or what kind of pronouns they might use. And, like, even those kind of small opportunities can be, like, a point to say, you know, oh, we don't really, like, maybe we don't know what the gender of that person. And even just kind of opening up that conversation to say that, you know, that we're not going to make those assumptions, or, you know, oh, you know, or pointing out, like, what do you notice about it? Right. Mm-hmm. What, you know, how do you respond if your kid is looking at, like, some other section of clothing in a store and is intrigued by, you know, wearing purple pants or something, who knows? But, you know, those are, again, these, like, small places where we can say, you know, oh, hey, yeah, there's no purple pants on this side of the store. If you want purple pants, like, how do we go about doing that? Right. And what does that look like? And, you know, is it safe for you to wear purple pants to school? Like,
yes. What is it going to mean?
What is it going to mean? What do you like about this? Yeah. And so just having those conversations, because then it gives your kids like an opportunity to understand how the world works and also to understand themselves in that context and better express themselves.
Yeah, absolutely. And I mean, it's, I love the fact that I'm again, kind of navigating this when Frankie's so young and Frankie's like three. So it's like, okay, good. Like, you know, build that foundation because, you know, even in my conversations with her, you know, interacting with her other kids at the playground, it's, and even interesting how she's playing around with pronouns and sometimes saying he or her, or, you know, and just kind of mixing them up. And then it's like, okay, well, you know, this can be kind of a start of a conversation of, you know, do we assume that kid over there is a boy or, and call him he, or do we use the pronoun they, and just, you know, to kind of cover our bases so that we're not making those assumptions with the people that we come into contact with who we don't know and who we, you know, have no idea, you know, how they express themselves or how they like to be called. Yeah. Do you find that, you know, a they is a good kind of cover your bases when it comes to, you know, recognizing someone, or is that even too much of an assumption?
I mean, I think when we're talking to kids about like some random person that we have no interaction with or like very little, like, you know, we're just kind of like, oh, they're on the slide, you know, like that kid is on the slide. They're like using the slide. That I think in English, you know, they is a pronoun that we've always used in the singular sense. We don't really think about it, but it's actually the commonly used pronoun when we don't know the gender identity, or we haven't made assumptions about the gender identity and expression of the person we're talking about. And so, you know, it's also just a great way to introduce like neutralizing language, but also like not making assumptions, you know, to mm-hmm. our kids in that context. So I think in English, it works really well. There's definitely, you know, more challenges depending on what language you speak at home. I mean, some languages don't really have much of gendered pronouns in use at all. And so that's another thing that we could, you know, kind of think through as English speakers primarily. Mm-hmm. In French, you know, that's can be a little bit trickier, and some of the romantic, like the Latin languages and romantic languages, because everything is gendered, like tables are gendered, computers are gendered, right? Glasses are gendered.
Which I always found so strange learning French in school, because it's like, why?
Right. And Spanish, you know, speakers are the same. And even German has a lot of gendered language. So, you know, it is more complicated. So in essence, we have it. It's like one of the times where English is less complicated than other languages in some ways, where we have this option. And I think, you know, it is one way that we can use it to both like practice it ourselves and not make those assumptions. And then, you know, if somebody then that we meet, you know, we have been talking about them using they, them pronouns, and we learn that they use she, her pronouns or he, him pronouns or another pronoun, then we just switch. Right. And I think, you know, that is one way of teaching our kids that piece around not making assumptions that can be really powerful without too much effort, really.
Yeah. Yeah. Especially, I mean, I get flashbacks to when I was a kid, because of course I have, with my first name being Tony, it's like a traditional, like masculine male name. And when I was younger, I had short hair, so I would get, you know, misgendered. You know, mostly adults would just say, oh yeah, that boy, blah, blah, blah. It was upsetting. And I was the kind of kid where I was too shy to actually correct them. So and it would have been so
this is such
nicer.
An important point. Like, you're, yeah. I think you, this story tells me everything that, like, you know, because parents are often like, well, what if my kid is like, it is cisgender, then it doesn't matter. And my point is that, like, we live in such a gendered situation that tons of women have this experience of being mm-hmm. misgendered as kids or as teenagers, even. Yeah. I mean, I too have gone through stages in my life with shorter hair where I wore like, baggier clothing.
Baggy pants, baggy sweatshirts.
And baggy sweatshirts and maybe a hood up, and often would get misgendered. And I think, you know, if we look at some boys also share in that experience, if they grow their hair long, for whatever reason, like because they like it or because of cultural or ethnic or religious purposes, that they too often get misgendered, even though they themselves might identify as like boys who were assigned male at birth and are still, you know, kind of harmed by these assumptions that we make. And so I think that's the important thing for parents to remember and to question with their kids, so that, you know, we're not kind of having, you know, that experience that you had or that other kids have where they don't feel confident in speaking up. And maybe there wasn't an adult there at the time who was like, who was like rolling their eyes, but like not bothering to correct the other person. And, you know, thankfully we could do better.
Yes. So then, especially having that experience, and it's like, I always kind of keep in mind that it's like, okay, you know, what seems to be a really kind of neutral language is they, and when it's like, a kid, a younger person saying the word, you know, kid can cover bases, or even just person, especially if it's an older adult, as well. And then actually practicing that, because I still will catch myself assuming that what I think is a boy is a boy, or what I think maybe is a girl is a girl, where
which is normal. I mean, we're all going to make mistakes. And I think like that's the other thing, is to like be compassionate with ourselves and with our kids in this process, so that, you know, we recognize that like we've all grown up with like these systems that have encouraged us to make assumptions, to categorize, and to put people into neat boxes that are M and F. And so, you know, we're in recognizing that like having kids and the world and people are a bit messier than two boxes. And that's beautiful and wonderful. That then, you know, we have to kind of be kind to ourselves to say like, yeah, we're going to make mistakes. We're going to make assumptions, and then we might have to correct ourselves, or like me, I have teenagers, they correct me all the time. Right.
And oh, perfect. That's always wonderful, right?
They'll be like, actually you don't know. And then you have to remind yourself, right? Oh yeah. Right. I didn't catch that. Thanks for pointing that out. But you know, that we have these opportunities to be more aware, to bring more attention to, you know, our language and our assumptions. And that helps our kids build critical thinking skills and self-reflection and all these other pieces that have nothing to do with like sex, gender, or sexual orientation that we want to instill in them anyways. So
bonus.
Bonus.
Yay. Oh, perfect. Yeah. In terms of even pronouns and the conversation around pronouns. We had some family visiting this summer, and one of the younger, not so younger kids, you know, was really kind of starting to grill us about like how we felt about like, you know, Pride Month or, you know, that kind of thing, as kind of an introduction in terms of talking about gender identity and pronouns and that kind of thing. I wonder, especially in terms of tweens, teens, that idea of some kids just knowing what expression they are, or even knowing that they are more fluid and don't really fit in one label or another, versus other kids who aren't quite sure or haven't thought about it? Or is there a pressure to decide or to pick what label you are, what pronouns you're going to use? And I don't know how you kind of navigate that with your kids or even in general.
Sure. I mean, I think, you know, what we know about ourselves is like our sense of fashion and our sense of expression changes all the time. Like if I think about myself, you know, when I was like the age, I have a 12-year-old and a 14-year-old now. When I was that age, I was like, you know, exploring my punk rock self, and I shaved my head a bunch of times. I wore my hair in very unusual styles. I colored it all sorts of colors of the rainbow. You know, I wore like dresses with like big tall boots that were like, you know, or like would wear like jeans that I bought in the men's section, right? And like big baggy hoodies that there was like, I'm a very 90s kid.
Oh, I'm very 90s too.
Haven't figured this out, yep. Right? Yep. So,
because I actually like stole my dad's pants and would wear my dad's pants, right? Like,
obviously,
yeah,
right?
Obviously,
I think every woman who grew up in the 80s and 90s did that because there really were no other styles available to us. But I think, you know, if I look through, if I think back, and I think many of us can reflect on this, like there's like that version of me that was, you know, somewhat like that expressed myself through clothing and through my attitude and through my behavior in ways that like maybe would be read in a specific kind of gender compared to like my 7-year-old self that was like, you know, super into, I trained as a ballerina before I became a naturopath. And so I was like, you know, had all those kind of more like traditionally feminine ballerina characteristics. And, you know, at other times in my life, I've, you know, had really short hair. I'm sure you can remember. Mm-hmm. I've had really long hair. And I think so many of us like have this way of that we don't even necessarily attach to gender, that, but we've considered okay about expressing ourselves, especially folks who are women, you know, in like a third wave feminist kind of approach, right? Like there's no right way to be a woman. Mm-hmm. And we've instilled that, I think, in a lot of our children and our daughters in particular. And then, you know, what's I think more challenging perhaps is like, how do we apply that fluidity to people who are assigned male at birth or who are boys and letting them explore without having it attached to an identity? And that's, it's hard as a parent to be like, yeah, sure. You want to wear a dress, who cares? Maybe you're going to want to wear a dress for 2 months and then you're going to stop wearing dresses. And that's actually part of normal child development in those young ages, right? Like I said, between 2 to 7, kids are exploring, they're fitting, trying things on, they're fitting in, they're figuring out what they like. And that happens again in the teen years in different ways. And that's a normal part of development that doesn't mean anything necessarily about their identity. And it's easy for us as parents to be like, what is this? You know, because we're parents.
Yes. So, and we like to make things mean certain things and figure it out and analyze it and have it all set.
Just the kid doesn't sleep well for one night and we're like, oh my gosh, it's a sleep regression. We might attach, you know, this kind of like more, want to attach deeper meaning to what is, you know, nothing more than like play and normal, like I said, normal child development of sense of self. And other times, like, you know, and that's a good time to be like, hey, some people do this, some people do that. This is totally normal. This is, you know, this is what this looks like. That can be an opportunity for introducing those concepts. What we know from research again is that like, no matter how open you are and how many of those like options you present, or whether or not you're like parenting your kid in like very cis normative, heteronormative ways, or whether or not you're, you know, kind of introducing the idea that gender is a galaxy, that's not going to have an impact on the gender identity of your kids. Mm-hmm. You're not going to turn your kids cisgender. You're not going to turn your kid transgender. That, you know, most of us have kids who are headstrong, many of us, but even kids who are not, you know, going to speak up necessarily, their sense of their own identity is going to develop regardless of what we do.
Yeah.
And so
much like sexual orientation,
Like sexual orientation, no matter what, I mean, you know, there's a long period of time where like, it was definitely not okay to be out as, mm-hmm. as gay or lesbian or bisexual. And that did not mean that there were any fewer numbers of people who were attracted people of, you know, of one gender or another or many genders out there in the world. And so we're not going to change that about somebody. What we can do is provide an environment that is supportive. And like I said, that's that's the most important thing. That's what every parent wants to be able to do, is to support their kid and in whatever their identity is and how they want to express themselves within, within the set of family values that they have, or within the ways that they, feel are appropriate for their kid. And, that kind of way of thinking, I think is important for us to like remember when we're talking about it, that it doesn't necessarily mean anything. There are tons of resources. Like if your kid was like, hey, actually, you've been raising your kid, you assumed your kid was a boy forever and ever, and your kid's like, hey, actually, I'm not a boy, then like it's our job as parents to listen to them and be like, okay, tell me more about that. Right?
Yes.
And yes. Then to go out and do our homework and like find resources and parent groups and maybe some like social service organizations to help us navigate that if we're not sure about how to navigate it. But we're just setting the stage so that our kids do feel okay telling us, like, they're like, hey, I realized I'm, pansexual. And you're like, I have no idea what that is. And you're like on Google as a parent, that's okay too.
Yeah, and it's funny because I was just thinking as you were talking, it's like, oh, now I get the difference between like why people are considering themselves pansexual instead of bisexual. Again, because I was had previously just really focused on this idea of this like binary and this spectrum. It's like, no, if we think of the galaxy and how someone can be attracted and have a relationship to any of those galaxies, then okay, that makes sense in terms of pansexual. So I didn't need to Google it. Thanks, Cindy.
No problem. But I think it's also like true that bisexual has always meant that people who are bisexual are attracted to more than one gender. Mm. It doesn't necessarily mean that binary either.
Okay. Thanks.
Yeah.
Thanks for clarifying that.
No. it does have bi in the name. Yeah. And so that can be confusing because obviously most of us know that like either associate that with two or with binary as short form for it. I think that like that's the piece, is that we're setting it up so that our kids can tell us and that they feel comfortable telling us those things, or like telling us about a crush, or multiple crushes, or whatever it is that they're going through and thinking through, and then finding resources for us as parents, like if we maybe aren't sure how we feel about that, right? If a kid comes out to you and you're like, I don't know how I think about this, and I'm worried about like X, Y, and Z, and like what about this? Then it's our job as parents to like then reach out and get help for ourselves in those conversations, so that, we're not necessarily like imposing those fears or those concerns or those questions on our kid, but also getting resources for our kids to navigate the world, in ways that will promote their health in the best ways possible.
And that's so perfect, because I mean, what I'm really getting out of our conversation is the piece of like, not only having that open conversation and communication with our kids, but also, I mean, if there is anything expressed, not to like, jump to conclusions of, oh, this means that my kid must be trans or my kid must be gay or any of those pieces, but just seeing it as, to just give them some wiggle room to ask questions, that could even be like, well, what does that mean to you? Or,
Or what else should I know about that? Like, thanks for sharing with me. Absolutely. Right. There are so many ways that we can respond that like, we don't have to attach a label either. Right.
Yes. Yeah. Which is key. Especially in this kind of society and culture where we love labels.
Yeah. And there are some times where we might want to take action. There are very specific limited scenarios, obviously, where like if a kid is transgender and they really are like concerned about going through puberty, that is a good time to consult with family physicians and with like experts in that field, because there are options. And those are worth talking about, right? If your kid is like, absolutely, I really don't want the, like, what estrogen is going to do in my body. And that's, that is, you know, that is a concern for me as like a 12-year-old, and that's a conversation that needs to be had, right? Mm-hmm. But mm-hmm. most of the time, those conversations don't have to like have an endpoint. We don't have to like assume that every kid who's exploring gender and sexual orientation like needs a consult with a doctor, or is like necessarily going to mean that they want to like hormonally transition or surgically transition. And that's just us as parents, like, you know, having like that natural concern for our kids, right?
Absolutely. Absolutely. It's I mean, especially with, I mean, of course there's the piece of this has always been happening. Like there always have been people who are cis and people who are trans and
people who are non-binary,
intersex, and all of those pieces. Yeah. And when we see, I mean, statistics, and you probably know this way more than I do, in terms of the numbers of say girls or teenage girls or young women who are then identifying as trans. And I think there's a real kind of concern out there. And there's even, I wonder, you know, where is this coming from? Is this an exploration? Is this a kind of rejection of how women are seen in a patriarchal culture? Just maybe. Or is this like just real, a real true expression of, you know, who these kids are that really hasn't been recognized before?
And I think what you're saying
or
right now
been
is
open
like,
to be recognized before
is so key, because there are so many pieces around this, right? That we jump to conclusions about what someone's identity might mean and what the like what we think that amounts to. And I mean, the reality is that there are plenty of trans and genderqueer and non-binary folks who like are happy with their bodies the way they are. They're happy with their endogenous hormones the way that they are, that we're already like imposing this assumption that being trans means I want to change something, and as opposed to just how I feel about myself. And so I think, you know, this, and then as you said, like, how does identity intersect with all these other pieces, with, you know, colonial notions of gender or about sex or about roles of people in society who like have been attached to certain things? What's my relationship to the heteropatriarchy? What is, you know, my relationship to expectations around like what it means to be X, Y, or Z, or A, B, C, D, E. And so, you know, this, it is much more complicated. And then you add to that, you know, what we know has existed, especially for folks who don't present as cisgender or don't identify as cisgender, that there is so much stigma. And, you know, it's really pretty recent that like even folks who are lesbian, gay, bisexual, and other sexual orientations have felt comfortable and have had, depending on where you are, equal rights in society from a legal perspective, that all these concepts are so new that stigma and discrimination and structural oppression that folks who are LGBTQ2SIA plus identified face. And we didn't even talk about intersex folks much, but like that's a whole other conversation. And so that discrimination and that stigma is the source of most of the mental health stuff too, right? And it is those like that enacted stigma, whether it's in schools, whether it's at home, whether it's in workplaces, that is, you know, it is part of the reason why people might make certain choices that don't necessarily reflect who they are too, and the way that we label things, right? Comes back to a label doesn't mean anything. It's just a label. It's just a name that maybe helps us to position ourselves relative to other folks, might serve to be really positive and give us a sense of community, right? But might also alienate us if others make assumptions about what that means. So I think it comes back to, like, as parents, just being, remembering, like, that, you know, matter what our hopes and fears are for our children, that our biggest job is to support them in becoming the wonderful human that they are going to be, and to help them, to give them all the tools and resources to do that, regardless of these pieces around sex and gender and sexual orientation.
Oh, yeah. That's perfect. I love that. I think that really, really summarizes kind of, you know, everything that we've talked about, and just even what to really keep in mind as a parent. So thanks, Cindy. So like you said, resources are so key. You know, we are lucky to be in centers in Canada where there are some really great resources, in person, but also online. So what would you be your favorite resources for parents who want more information, how to navigate, these kind of conversations, maybe to get, like, the, a reliable source of information instead of just Googling what is pansexual. what would you recommend?
For sure. I think, like, you know, for me, it starts, like, with, like, having those conversations early on. Mm-hmm. And as a parent, like, not every parent, I mean, I'm totally comfortable talking about sex and gender with my kids, but I recognize that not every parent feels comfortable having those conversations because maybe that was never modeled for them when they were growing up, or their, like, sex ed class in school that they got was, like, the worst thing ever.
Or their mom just handed them a book and told them to read it.
Like, right.
Like me.
Like many of us. So I think, you know, that books are a great starting place. I highly recommend the books that are written by Corey Silverberg. They're illustrated by Fiona Smith. So they're, like, bright, they're beautiful, they're, like, they express the diversity of human existence. And they start, there's, like, it's a series of books that starts with a book called What Makes a Baby.
Awesome.
And that actually is, you know, is great in the sense of, like, explaining, you know, where babies come from, but all the different ways that they can be born, and, like, what the importance of sperm and egg are, that, like, exist in ways and present it in ways that fit for all families and awesome. All ways of conception happening and all ways of giving birth. Their next book is a book called Sex is a Funny Word, which is, like, more for kids and parents of, like, tweens, that kind of explains a little bit more about, like, puberty and relationships and gender and in ways that are more appropriate for, like, kids in that, like, you know, kind of, depending on your kids, 7 to 12 year old range. Mm-hmm. And then they have a new book that's coming out soon called, you know, Sex, Bodies, Gender, Puberty, and Other Things, that's, like, more geared towards, like, the basics for kids.
Awesome.
There is a sex educator here in Ontario named Nadine Thornhill, who helps families and parents and teachers and kids learn about everything from, like, consent and talking about, like, how to name body parts and anatomy, and again, like, what puberty looks like in ways that are positive and sex positive and sexuality positive, but still, like, age appropriate. And I think that that's, like, a really important piece. And we'll put all of this stuff in the show notes.
Yes.
If you want books that, like, just, you know, because you're like, I don't have any friends or family members or, like, extended people in my community that would represent the kind of diversity that I'd like my kid to just know exists in the world. There's books like, there's a publisher called Flamingo Rampant that publishes books that are racially diverse and LGBTQ positive. And then a bunch of other books that we'll put in the show notes. And then for teens, I highly recommend that teens, like, have space to explore their own resources, and even tweens, that there is benefit to having conversations, and then also benefit to letting them explore things on their own. But using trusted resources. So for those kids, I love the website called Scarlatine, which is, like, a very inclusive website that talks about sexuality and relationships, and it's geared towards teens and provides, like, really solid evidence-informed advice that is both sex positive and, like, contains all the info they need about sexual health and politics, and even like include stuff around disability and other intersections as they navigate their bodies, their gender, and their sexual identities.
Awesome. That's some great like mama must-haves in there. So that's perfect, Cindy.
Oh yeah.
Now, if anyone wants to contact you, get more information about you, your practice, your teaching, what you have available, how can people connect with you?
Yeah, best way is definitely, I have my website, which is cindygilbert.ca. I spell my name like Cindy Lauper, CyndiGilbert. And I'm sure you'll put that link in the show notes.
Absolutely.
And then obviously I am also on social media and people can follow me at Dr. Cindy ND.
Perfect. Awesome. Thanks so much for joining us, Cindy. Now, do you have some time to join us for the super mom moment and mama mess up?
Oh yeah, let's do
it. Awesome. Let's do that. And first, before we jump into that, I can share my mama must have for today. Being that we're in the fall, and immune health, I think, is very much on the top of our minds. Now we would have talked about extensively vitamin D in a previous episode. So you guys can check out that in the show notes. In addition to that, I'm a big fan of herbs. I think, Cindy, you're a big fan of herbs for supporting.
I'm definitely a big fan of herbs.
For supporting immune function, immune balance, immune modulation. One of my favorites is astragalus. And I often will recommend a product. I have no connection to it other than our a dear teacher and mentor of ours, Dr. Anthony Godfrey, was involved in creating a combination called Deep Immune by St. Francis Herbs. So that's kind of one of my favorites. So I'm a big fan of using, you know, astragalus, Deep Immune, in the fall to, again, support balance and modulation. And absolutely, if you have any immune concerns, definitely see your healthcare provider before, you know, using those kind of herbs as well. So yeah. Okay, let's jump into super mom moments and mama mess ups.
Oof, so many on both sides of the ledger. I think we all do when we really come into it.
So, absolutely. Go for it.
I think my super mom moment was the first week of high school for my oldest. Mm-hmm. And, you know, huge transition. Anyone who's gone through this, first kid in high school during COVID, right?
Whoa.
So there's been a whole bunch of disruption and the kids haven't really been in school for the past 2 years full time here where we are in Toronto. And so it's been very disrupted. And that transition is, I think, a bit different and a bit more challenging for kids, but they're back in person, which was so exciting. And my kid came home and my big kind of my super mom moment was that my kid came home and said, there are all these people in my class and I don't know any of them. And this is a kid who can be something very observant and cognizant and a bit quieter initially, happy to socialize, but not always the most confident. And, and he's born in November. So he's one of the youngest in that grade, in every grade that he's ever been in. And so I think that plays into all these things too. And he was I just realized that in high school, I can just be myself. And that's okay because everyone else is trying to figure out who they are too. And I was wow, you just that's what teenage years is all about. Go, you're done. I've launched you. It's fine.
It was gold star to you, Cindy. Gold star.
Yeah. So definitely super mom moment, recognizing that next week or the week after, he may not feel exactly the same way when he comes home. But in that one moment that he felt he could be himself, I was just I'm done. My job here is done. Amazing.
But, you know, but not really, but yeah.
Yeah, no, definitely not. And then in terms of mama mess ups, I mean, there are so many mess ups. I think I shared already that my kids are not afraid to correct me all the time. And you know, like, they're like, you can't make that assumption. Don't say that. Right. And I learned so much from them in this regard. And I think, like, one of my most egregious mess ups, given that, like, this is what I teach all the time. And, you know, like, if you ask my youngest, you ask them, like, what does your mom do? They might be like, sometimes my mom teaches people how not to be sexist, racist, homophobes for a living. But so given that, I had this moment where I think we were like, we were booking with like a doctor that we didn't know. And I didn't know the first name. I didn't know the last name. And I was like, I made those assumptions and I wasn't thinking. And, you know, no matter how much we do this, we're like always unlearning. And so I must have said something like, oh, I hope that he's nice, or like, I hope that we like him, or I can't remember exactly, because I was not, you know, I was in that like autopilot mode where I made an assumption that I did not realize that this doctor was going to be a man, which is all sorts of loaded, sexist, internalized thinking.
And from a doctor yourself.
From a doctor myself, yes, as a doctor who identifies as a woman. That was, you know, hilarious and also definitely a mama mess up and a super mom moment at the same time, because my kids were like, mom, you can't make an assumption that the doctor is a man.
Amazing. Oh, Cindy, gold star to you.
It was
gold star to you.
It's like, you know, trying to keep my super mom moments and my mama mess ups related to our topic today.
Yeah. I love it. Thank you. Whereas my super mom moment and my mama mess up will not be related to the topic today.
That's okay.
And that's all right, right? Well, and I mean, maybe our previous topic, because my super mom moment is actually, you know, taking Frankie to day home. Sometimes, you know, especially in the past, I would just, you know, automatically put her in the car and drive her over. But I am really focusing on getting outside and not using the car as much, maybe more for my physical health benefit and mental health benefit than really
still
like,
worth it.
You know, that's environmental. Still- and so even like, you know, this morning it was 0 degrees when I checked the weather. This
nobody
morning.
Can see my face right now, but I am terrified by that temperature.
Oh, you know, Calgary weather. So we just bundled up. Frankie wanted to ride her bike, got her mittens on, and we just went. And so, yes.
That is truly a super mom moment, that like early October in 0 degrees, you just put the mittens and the jacket and get warm and get on the bike. And
it's all about, the clothing, right? It's all about the clothing you wear.
It's all about what you wear. Yeah.
Now my mama mess up actually happened last week in taking her the day home. And I give her the choice of she can ride her bike or I can push her in the stroller. And so she chose the stroller. So it was like, okay, went. And it's like, it's about 40, 45 minutes, like both ways. So it's not short. And of course, then I like get myself together for work and stuff. And so took her to day home, was almost home, like on our block. And I realized I didn't have my house keys. So I had left them in the stroller at the day home.
Oh,
no one was home. I had to walk all the way there and back. And thankfully, I had just a reschedule in my morning so that I managed to go home, shower, dress, get to work, and be right there for my first patient of the day.
Oh, that's more like a mama save moment.
Oh,
saved, barely.
Saved, but a mess up. So that's the learning experience. I don't want it to happen again. I don't want to make that save again. So yeah, there we go. So anyway, again, thank you so much, Cindy, for joining us today. I loved all the information you shared. Such an important conversation. So I really appreciate your time and expertise on this.
Yeah, Tony, thanks so much for having me again. It's always a pleasure.
And thanks everyone for joining us. Again, you can find our show notes at our website, perimenopausalmamas.com. You can connect with us on Instagram, Facebook. If you enjoyed this episode, please give us a 5-star review, subscribe, and tell your perimenopausal mama friends about us too. So stay safe and healthy, everyone. Bye.
Bye.